Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello?
Hello, could I please speak with Sister Helen Prejean?
You are doing that.
Isn't that wonderful? Sister Helen, I love a conversation that begins with a laugh. I always do.
Good. It's so good to talk to you.
Oh, it's so
And good. It's Prejean, your little Yankee or whatever you are. It's Prejean because I'm French, not that Prejean thing.
Prejean, you know, I because I'm a linguistic monster, I really don't know. I would have said Prejean.
The nun will set you straight.
I would have said Prejean. How do you pronounce it perfectly?
Well, we kind of anglicize it a little bit. We'd say Prejean.
But how would you do it?
It would be Prejean.
Prejean.
In French, it would be Prejean.
Well, that's what I would
but
say.
We've anglicized
Prejean. Let's begin again. Sister Helen Prejean, it's a delight to speak with you. Where am I reaching you?
You are reaching me in New Orleans, where I am sequestered during this pandemic.
What do you do with your days?
Well, actually, my days are getting busier. I have to tell you, Paul, this is the first time since Dead Man Walking came out in 93 and set off this tsunami, because the book was a huge success. It quickly spawned a film, which won an Academy Award, and I was out there in the public with a deep moral imperative, really, because I had witnessed executions, and it was a secret process, and most people thought it was a fine idea. So I've been out on the road to get to the people, and people say, you need to take a sabbatical, you need to take a break. I couldn't, because we got to end this thing of government torturing and killing people. So I needed a big permission. Well, I just got one with the pandemic, and so I am home. And I spend my days, first of all, starting to write a new book. Secondly, getting in requests to come and speak. And then I have to decide, well, I probably in person is going to be off limits for the unforeseeable future. Until we have a vaccine, we don't have a way of being together in public without assuring that we're not going to be spreading this thing. And so learning how to work Zoom and being in conversations. I'll be doing a thing with DePaul University in next week. They have the archives of Dead Man Walking and have some Zoom exchanges with classes of writers, of social justice groups, and so learning to, you know, have the new ways of communicating. But I'm also home and I got to plant flowers and I can to be here to water them. It's so sweet. Louisiana is so warm and balmy and verdant and the flowers are blooming. And I'm so glad to be home and have permission to be home.
I like the fact that you use the word permission.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, Elie Wiesel said this about the Holocaust. When you have been brought in to witness something that most of society does not know exists, then what is your mandate? What is your moral imperative as a witness? And it is to be a witness, to wake up the people, to say, look, I must tell you, this is going on. And we have to connect and unite to change things. And that's been my mandate, you know, with the death penalty. And How do you say, I don't want to do this anymore? How do you say, but I've witnessed 6 human beings, 3 electrocuted and 3 lethally injected. So you can't just put that down and just say, I don't want to do this anymore. I think I'll get a new graduate degree in something. You have to. And you owe it to the human beings who were tortured and who were killed. And no one lamented their deaths. In fact, some celebrated their deaths, saying that's what we needed to do in society. And so it's just, you have to just keep hearing what's going on and what am I asked to do. In faith terms, people of faith say, God, what do you want me to do? What is my call? What is my vocation? So right now, mine is to be at home. We are burning up the lines with our Twitter and our social media about the condition of prisoners with the COVID-19 things in jails and prisons.
Tell me about that. Tell me about that. Of course, I have many questions about that. Tell me about distancing in prisons and what that could even mean and what you hear, because you really are on the front line, as it were, of understanding what might happen in prisons for having witnessed.
I'm going to give you the first paragraph of the ACLU class action suit about the federal prison in Oakdale, Louisiana. They had a complete lockdown of the prison. They shut off all communication, and we were getting word from families. People are in there, they're all infected, and they're closed in on one another. You can't have social distancing. So the ACLU filed a class action suit, and in the very first paragraph, the way they positioned it and framed it was to say, suppose you are being put in a very small place, and you are smashed in with other people. You do not have a key to get out of the door. You are bound to be in there, and you cannot have any agency. You have no access to a phone to try to get help. And that is what prisoners are facing. And so, I mean, already the statistics coming out of the place are a lot of the correctional officers have been infected, and they're going in and out, picking up the infection, bringing it out to the public as well. But can you imagine being so trapped? So we just started putting it out like mad on Twitter. And then, of course, you always want to give people action.
Right.
You never just want to describe a situation.
Right.
So, of course, the action for Oakdale was to bombard the Bureau of Prisons. This is a federal prison. What are you going to do? You have an obligation to protect prisoners that have been entrusted to your care. And so for the public, the citizens, to do an outcry. And so that's our role.
I mean, I remember so clearly when you had your magnificent conversation, unforgettable throughout my lifetime, with Brian Stevenson at the isn't he amazing at the New York Public Library? I remember,
Paul.
God, I remember at the very end asking the question of both of you. Yes, this is all terrible, but what can we do? And Brian's response was so simple. He said, one thing anybody and everybody of the 500 people at the New York Public Library tonight can do is pick up a pen and write to somebody in solitary confinement, write to a death inmate. And I have to tell you, and not only did my wife write, but many other people that were there that night are simply writing every week, because the prisoners don't have any other social connection with the world. And so what can we do in that spirit, given this terrible pandemic? What can people actually do? Beyond, you know, posting on social media, what can a normal citizen who has the luxury of being socially separate, which prisoners don't have, do?
It's just what Brian said. See, that human connection. Remember reading and hearing about the Amnesty International campaign around the world to write a letter to a political prisoner?
Yeah,
I mean, the aloneness of being in a prison, the aloneness, and also the thousand signals you get a day that you're nothing more than disposable human waste. The disrespect us. And to get a letter. So to just write to the different Department of Corrections in states, the Bureau of Prisons, just start getting names of prisoners in the United States. You know, the 2.2 million people incarcerated, not just the people on death row, and not just the people in solitary confinement, but just prisoners thrown away for huge parts of their lives. 2.2 million is called the fourth city. We have as many people imprisoned in the United States as the fourth largest city in America. And so that human contact, of course, that's what got me involved. I wrote a letter to a man on death row. I then, following the current of that, ended up witnessing his execution, which changed my life. But can you imagine what it means to be in a place and then suddenly there's mail calls and they call your name?
Right.
And you look and you have a letter from a human being. It gives you dignity. It says you are a human being.
Just recently, we celebrated Easter. And I'm wondering what the meaning of the holiday is for you as a Christian now. How do you, in these times, and maybe also with this pandemic, view and think about the resurrection?
Well, you have to connect the resurrection with the death of Jesus and how he was killed. And I'm looking up at a crucifix right here in my room here. It's right above my writing desk. And to me, that Jesus being executed along with the other poor people and the helpless, powerless people of his society. You had the Roman government to make an example of people, would hang them on two pieces of wood where they starved to death and where they just hung there and gradually suffocated to death. He's always, the Christ I know is always identified with the vulnerable and suffering people of society. What resurrection means for me is that giving of your life completely, the message of Jesus is, and the stories and gospels of his appearances, which of course are done in metaphor, which of course are done and he came through closed walls, whatever that experience was, the people, the apostles who had deserted him, who had betrayed him, who when he was taken away, they ran the other way, they let him be killed, and they were going to live the rest of their life with that guilt of knowing that they had betrayed him. Whatever those experiences were of Jesus after his death, the first one was that they were forgiven, that they had made a terrible mistake, but that love could endure, and then they were forgiven, and then they were mandated to hold each other fast, to be a community, and then to go and continue to do what he had done, which was to reach out to each other and love each other and help to heal all the brokenness in the world. That's Eastering. That, to me, is what resurrection means. It used to be we just thought of it as, oh, well, Jesus rose from the dead, then one day I'm going to rise from the dead too. And it was an ego-centered thing. Me, Helen Prejean, as I am now, well, one day I'm going to get through on the other side. I will continue to be Helen Prejean and my little ego self. But it's breaking out of that ego into a sense of community and love and connectedness with everyone. That, to me, is what the resurrection experience is.
And, you know, in that spirit, James Cone, the theologian, wrote the following in his memoir, said, I wasn't going to tell nobody. He said, and I'd like you to react to it. He said, present-day Christians misinterpret the cross when they make it a non-offensive religious symbol, a decorative object in their homes and churches. The cross, therefore, needs a lynching tree to remind us what it means when we say that God is revealed in Jesus at Golgotha, on the cross where criminals and rebels against the Roman state were executed. The lynching tree is America's cross. lynched black bodies a symbol of Christ's body. If we want to understand what the crucifixion means for Americans today, we must view it through the lens of the mutilated black bodies whose lives are destroyed in the criminal justice system. Jesus continues to be lynched before our eyes. He is crucified wherever people are tormented.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. That is, you know, it kind of reminds me coming out of Latin America with what liberation theology about identifying with the poor. And as some of the people identified with all the death squads and all the suffering in Latin America said, it is time to take people off the cross. And people, you see these jeweled crucifixes, you see earrings made of crosses, like it's a decorative piece. And not only do you see that, Paul, you actually see the execution of Jesus interpreted as God supporting government-approved executions. Do you know that recently in Wyoming, they were really close to repealing the death penalty, and the senator that blocked it said, well, if Jesus hadn't been executed on the cross by the Romans, we would not be saved from our sins. And that quickly translates into, these people did a terrible murder, they're executed for their crimes, and thereby save their souls. Yeah. So it's not only neutral or decorative, it's actually used to further the torture and the killing as if God approves it. And only the pain and sacrifice of taking a life will be sufficient because they have taken lives.
Sister Helen, you said recently that you see a lot of parallels between the Good Friday Passion narrative and the lives of people like Dr. Martin Luther King and Oscar Romero. How so?
You know, when the Gospels are written, they're written afterwards from a point of view of faith. And, but God, think of it at the time. I think of being in that execution chamber with Pat Sonia.
Yeah.
And you just see them going through their ritual. It's all silent. It's just you there. You're going, what? Look at this. What is going on? What's going on? And so you had Martin Luther King. You had him going back to Memphis because they had had a march for the workers, the sanitation workers who were just looking for the barest of minimum wage, holding up signs saying, I am a man. And the first march they did turned to violence toward the end of the march. And here's Martin Luther going back into Memphis to do it again so they could do it nonviolently. And he was already given word that this man, James Earl Gray, was lurking in the city and looking to assassinate him. And for me, it's like the decision of Jesus. Mm. He had been hiding out in Galilee because he knew that the temple cult, the religious leaders, were out to execute him. Because he was changing what faith meant. They were changing it. He was changing it. And his decision to go into Jerusalem for the feast, where they did arrest him, and they did kill him. I think of Martin Luther King and that decision to go back into Memphis. And with Oscar Romero, you know, he had been kind of a conservative bishop. He was more on the side of, you know, when you're a conservative and you have lunch with the wealthy and they give you the money to build your cathedrals, then you kind of side with them. And it's hard to identify with poor people. Well, when he had his conversion, a priest really close to him who kept going and was with the peasants, with the poor people who were being killed by the death squads. And he kept telling him, Oscar, look what the military is doing to our people. When he made that decision to stand up in the cathedral during Mass and say to the military, do not be part of it, of killing your own people. He knew by saying those words, he was risking his life forever, and shortly after that, he was assassinated while he was saying Mass. So there comes a point, we're all just human beings, and we get on a road and we start just doing a bit once we become awake to something that's really terrible, and you go down the road, and choosing to continue to go down that road leads to your death. And so I think of both of them, and I think of Jesus deciding to go into Jerusalem, and they were waiting for him, and sure enough, the religious leaders of the day were behind his death and turned him over to the Romans. And for the Romans, it was easy. He was just one more troublemaker. Get him out there on Golgotha and hang him up on the tree, and he'll be done with.
And you met Martin Luther King.
Briefly. I really met him in two ways, Paul. I met him briefly in the O'Hare Chicago airport when I was coming home from Canada, and he had just had this terrible experience in Cicero, Illinois, where he had tried to you know, the boycott in Montgomery and the whole civil rights movement. He tried to bring it into a white neighborhood, and people were throwing bricks at him and spitting on him. And I only realized afterwards that he was in that airport. He was coming home from that experience. He was standing behind me in line. We were at the ticket counter, and I went, that's Dr. King. And I just walked back in the line, just took his hand. I said, Dr. King, thank you for what you're doing. I'm praying for you. And he goes, oh, sister. He said, pray, we need so much help. He was so tired. Then later, my real meeting with him, our in-depth meeting, was when I read his life. Mm. When I read that meeting in Chicago, had come out of that experience in Cicero, Illinois, and what he had been experiencing, he realized how deep the racism and the divide was in the community.
Recently, the Pope spoke about the pandemic, and reading it, I was rather impressed. And I'm wondering whether you share that this sentiment.
You know, I've heard some of what he has said. The basic symbol that I've gotten from what he said is this thing is so big. The currents in the river or the ocean are so big. And we are in this little boat of humanity. And we must learn to row together. It's getting us out of our individualistic way of being in a way that's unprecedented. We really are in very dire straits in the United States. 22 million people now have filed for unemployment.
Incredible.
48. Yes. And so people, and I've been following the PBS news, which it keeps showing people telling their stories of what's happening to them. And you see, for example, like in long lines, miles of cars waiting to get food. It has thrown us out of our comfortable little nuclear individualistic little families and units. We don't need each other, into this whole other experience. And the Pope's calling for, and the best part of each of us is calling for, and what real religion is calling for, faith, is that we connect and that we are interdependent and that we need each other and that we will help each other and not let this further divide us. Just seeing those lines of the cars in Dallas and realizing 22 million people have now filed for unemployment is the greatest since the Great Depression. It's so easy for a society to come unglued and for violence to break out. Because people need food. People need shelter. You need to be able to pay your rent. And suddenly people are just destabilized in all these essentials of life. So it's we're really in dire straits. And the Pope was just saying, we need each other. Let us turn to help each other. We're in this together.
Do you see some hope that will come out of this pandemic? By that I mean different ways in which we might interact with each other, different forms of conviviality. I know that you're a great lover of this saying in Latin America, what the eye doesn't see, the heart can't feel.
Right.
And I'm wondering now, you know, we have this moment, which to you offers a moment of respite from your maddening schedule where you can sit back, but we will again come together socially. And I'm wondering if you have some hope in that regard.
I do. I learned from this man, Brian Swin, about the rules and forces of the universe, the 10 forces within the universe. And one of the forces in the universe is cataclysm. Sometimes things break apart in such a radical way that it gives us a chance to reconfigure in a new way. In some ways, I see that. For example, look at the efforts of some of the people in Congress to try to undo the Affordable Care Act, to call it socialism. Look at the attitude that has been present of, we don't need government. Government's the problem. Let's each individually pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and let's let the marketed economy be the thing to save us. Now, with people losing their health care en masse because they're losing their jobs, will we ever look at health care for all Americans in the same way again? I think it gives us fresh possibilities.
It does.
Look at the struggle.
It does.
Yeah,
it does. And the same is true, Sister Helen, about the environment. You know, we see nature in a different way.
Absolutely. We have not respected nature. In fact, we have felt that nature was there for our use with endless resources, for our own individualistic greed and gain. And we need to respect our earth and to care for our earth because that is our home.
Right.
And so just that, and similar to that is the approach to deny science. Look at the effect here with the pandemic and happening in the United States with the national leadership we now have with the White House, with the denial of science and all those signals coming in to our national leadership of the pandemic and how terrible it was going to be, and the denial, 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 all the way till way in mid-March where finally we began to do social distancing. That's because we were denying science. We have got to understand and let science help us. We're going to need the science of getting together to build the vaccine. We need the science
and the compassion.
Compassion, I think, happens when people suddenly realize, hey, this one that I have so othered, that immigrant at the boundaries of our country, that prisoner who had done that crime, these poor people, why don't they get off their butts and work? That distancing we have done with each other, when we are thrown into dire straits ourselves, it becomes an opportunity to blossom in compassion in a way we hadn't before. I do have hope for that.
Sister Helen, as always, what a privilege, a delight, a pleasure to talk with you. I wish we could more often, and I look forward to seeing you when we no longer need to remain separate, as it were, but I feel very, very united with you, and I send you for the moment a virtual hug. I really hope we can see each other soon again. It's always been such a pleasure. I want to leave you with a line of Camus. You need not comment, but I want to read it to you and then for you simply to reflect on it. Camus says, "Too many people have decided to do without generosity in order to practice charity." And I feel that your generous spirit just come through so loud and clear on a phone call such as this one. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you.
All the best. Bless you. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
To support this show and Dublab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.